Hello everyone, Heather here. Before we get started, I just wanted to give everyone a heads up. Today's novel will feature themes surrounding trauma stemming from abuse and confinement and suicidal ideation. If you aren't feeling up to it but want to hear about this particular author's work, I'll recommend you check out episode 7, where we read A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, and episode 19, featuring A Most Unusual Duke. Also, I might pronounce a bit of the Welsh language, so my apologies to Wales. After years of captivity, where he was forced to remain in his lion shape, Alwyn has lost touch with his essential self. If he cannot transform, he will die. However, the lady apothecary Tabitha isn't going to give up on him, even if it means losing her own heart. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. I'm excited because today we get to return to the beau monde with a third installment from Susanna Allen, A Duke at the Door. If you don't already know, this is a paranormal Regency historical romance series, which is already a lot to think about, but if you do know, then you know that I am absolutely bonkers for these books. Both of its predecessors have made it onto the Gold Star shelf, and I am eager to find out if this novel will live up to the reputation. To get us started, I'm going to go over a few quick terms so that we can have our bearings. In this world, shapeshifters are known as versipellis, and they refer to their transformations as their essential selves. It's not uncommon to see our romantic heroes conversing with their inner animal, and versipellian folk can range from maids to dukes, and even the Prince Regent George, also known as Prinny, is a bear shifter. It is the height of rudeness to ask what one's essential self is, and that information is only given when one wants to give it. Keeping the secret from the homo plenus, or regular humans, is absolutely paramount. Versipellis are also able to detect their soulmates, known as vera amoris. This is typically identified through scent, and the vera amoris in question could either be human or versipellis. Versipellis also keep their own deities. The wolves using the Roman pantheon, and the bears are using the Norse. Our hero today will make references to Celtic myths since he's from Wales. However, he often invokes a goddess named Palu, who, as best as I can figure, isn't fully canon to Celtic myth. That's the basic gist of things, more or less. The last novel did a decent job of keeping new readers in the loop, but this novel might lean a little more on the previous installments. I'll suggest that you read both of those books if you want a full picture, also because they're good. But enough of that, let's get started with A Duke at the Door. Our cover today looks pretty good. It follows the pattern established by the second novel, which is fine, but I really miss that dreamlike quality from the first book. Our hero and heroine are embracing each other. She is in a flowing yellow Regency dress, and she's pulling off a shirt because, of course. The background looks as though they are near an entrance of a great manor, and to the side is a statue of a lion. I really like this touch. Our previous novels reference the respective hero's shape with just images of their animals, but here it's alluded to with a tangible piece of the world in which they exist. That is some clever cover work, and I'm happy to see it. I like the color composition as well. The background is a mix of warm purples and pinks, which offsets the pop of yellow in the heroine's dress quite nicely. All in all, it's a good balanced cover. It still might get up to the standard that the Wolfie Duke gave us, but it's still good. But inside that cover is where the action is. We begin our story at a traveling menagerie. It's not the nicest of places, as evidenced by the state of some of the animals. A particular note is a lion, matted mane, stained white from wig powder. A worker wants to steal a gold chain that's been wrapped around his paw. When people find the man the next morning, he is basically gone mad, naked and shouting to anyone that would listen that the lion had turned into a man. The story proper begins in April of 1817, where we find Alwyn, Duke of Llewellyn, watching the dawn on the grounds of Lowell Hall. We will remember Lowell Hall and Lowell Close from the first novel, as home to Duke Alfred, wolf shifter and alpha of the Lowell pack. He's generously allowed Alwyn to stay on the grounds as the once former captive readjusts to life outside the menagerie. His thoughts drift to Carlton House. Loyal readers will recognize this scene. He has been asked to bear witness to the marriage between Arthur and Beatrice from the second novel. But Prince George has had other motives. He orders Alwyn to Lowell Close to rest and recuperate, to submit himself to the care of one Tabitha Barrington, a woman talented in healing tinctures and concoctions. Alwyn resists this, however. He thinks himself no better than Castleton, who we will remember as Beatrice's first husband, abusive and altogether unpleasant. Alwyn asks for George to put him down. He is not well, he can't shift, and the longer it goes, the sicker he will get until he dies. He only just wants to be done with it all. Prince George is an interesting character through these books. He's already an interesting historical figure for sure, but he cuts an intimidating image here. He is a bear shifter, like I said, and people are loath to cross him. Alwyn, however, has no such reservations and provokes George, perhaps as a way to get the prince to comply with his demands to, you know, put him down. No luck, off to Lowell Close he goes. He has been left more or less alone, an alpha with no pack, or rather pride, with the lost hope that he could return to his essential shape, or even find his vera immortis. In this mood, we find him with a view of the woman George had sent to help him heal. Alwyn paused in a familiar spot, his view through a lattice of sycamore branches, and observed that Barrington woman, that Barrington woman, styled as one of Mrs. Anstruther Asquith's heroines. Yet again, an anti-heroine, for no wilting debutante was she, and therefore no heroine. The Lady Apothecary was more in the line of a duenna or chaperone, her sober garments of little note, her willowy figure nowhere near au courant as determined by current society, her hair a diffident blondish brown, her eyes, oh, but those eyes, dark chocolate and doe-like, yet without a shred of innocence. They lit upon everything in their path with a measuring gaze, removed and considering. What would it take to inspire them to lose that detachment? He's been keeping an eye on her, mostly out of concern. It's interesting how he didn't really want to interact with polite society, but he's still casting a protective eye over the woman who finds herself in his sight. On the other end of this pseudo-relationship, Tabitha is more or less settled into her new home, a small cottage in Lowell Close. She and her brother had been traveling around the continent. Looks like there is some past pain in there, and now that they've brought their skills to the people in the Close. She is a healer, and her brother Timothy is a teacher. She was brought into the secrets of Versipellin society when she had visited Felicity and Beatrice near the end of the last novel. Prince George had arrived and had heard how skilled she was in the healing arts. He let her in on the secret and ordered her to the task of helping Alwyn heal. She takes the news that people can turn into animals in stride, and it seems she has a knack for being able to tell what someone's essential self is. Of course, this is not something to know unless asked, so she always keeps it to herself when she figures it out. And she could tell that Alwyn had been watching her all morning as she's gathering materials for her work. He'd been what could be charitably described as unreliable when it comes to making contact, but today they connect. Alwyn's behavior is very indeed cat-like. He doesn't approach her exactly, rather skirting alongside her and around her, never getting really close as a typical person would. He's still unsure of what to think of her, especially as she digs up poisonous plants to use as medicine. Tabitha is straightforward, her long travels having made her mostly immune to a wide variety of personality quirks, and he is somewhat off-put by how nonchalant she is about everything. He requests that she comes to the Sunday meal that Felicity hosts at the hall, to draw attention away from him if he needs it. She agrees, and again, much like a cat would, he dashes off quick as anything. The next portion of the narration serves as a good foundation to get to know our heroine. Part of the slice of life that I love to see in these novels, and we also get to catch up with previous characters. I like that our setting has brought us back to Lowell Close. I still have a soft spot for Felicity, horse girl that I am, and I'm happy to get to see more of her in this novel. However, this does run the risk of possibly alienating new readers. We all know that one of the tricks to romance novels is that you might not really need to read the previous books in order to enjoy the current one in a series. This is helpful when you're looking at a series that has upwards of 10 books or more. I have seen a series that spanned over 50. But The Shifters of the Beau Monde is only 3 books, and all 3 follow a mostly logical order. It appears to run along the same sort of vein as a fantasy series, only a different point of view in every novel. And the stories here all overlap one another, so it's logical to go quickly into one story from the next. If the author chooses to expand the series, it wouldn't be amiss to lump these three as a trilogy, and then maybe continuing on with another that could be read independently from this trilogy, but still featuring the same world and universe. Sunday rolls around, and fans of the British Regency high-class social scene would likely drink it up. I personally love the mixture of these genres. It's what made me fall in love with the first novel, British high society mixed in with that Versapellian world-building. We get a new taste of lore, the Curcio. It's a celebration where all the shifters get together and run around in their animal forms. It's to coincide with Astara, and it's meant to boost the social and physical health of the pack, because it's good for everyone to, you know, just let it all out and run around. Food is served, and Alwyn finds himself somewhat relieved that most of the attention was on the Barrington siblings as the newcomers. Tabitha and Timothy have been abroad so long that they've worn out of the stiff British posturing and are a little more robust than high society might expect. It allowed him to focus on what's in front of him, and what's in front of him is food that needs to be eaten with utensils. This moment is a good way of showing us where Alwyn is in his recovery. He's able to arrive and politely endure social graces, but he's still awkward and defensive. He comes dressed well enough, but in mismatched clothes he can only put on without any assistance from a valet. He's able to use spoons to eat his food, but when something comes along that requires a fork, he isn't sure if he can manage it without making a scene. He tumbles through a sort of silent inner monologue, peppered in with flashbacks, jealousy of Alfred's success in finding his Vera Amoris, and building pressure as he tries to move on like nothing is wrong when everything is wrong. While the butler nattered away and everyone carried on staring, his figure spasmed over the dreaded fork and the familiar frustration reared up within, as this essential creature once had, without thought, effortless. Now, no thought could reach his line, no emotion, nothing. He was alone, alone with his body and his thoughts, and no, he could not think on this now, not in front of all of these people looking at him, and as he was one breath from fleeing the room, that lady picked up a slice of lamb with her fingers and ate it. If it hasn't been clear before, Tabitha is well established as being an empathic individual. It's likely essential to her work as a healer, and now it is essential to helping Alwyn feel at ease among his peers. He was drowning, trying to rise to meet them at the table, so she swam down to meet him. And Timothy, being tuned into his sister, is able to break out an anecdote to explain away her actions. People ate lamb all the time with their fingers in grease, and he's happy to share their experiences. Being a school teacher, he's able to draw all attention onto himself, and everyone is happy to follow suit. Alwyn excuses himself from the after-dinner tea, and we're treated to more of that high society dialogue peppered in with the lore. Here the author uses the conversation as a way to give some lore exposition, as Tabitha seeks to gain more understanding of Versapellian nature. They dive into the role of the Omega. Readers will recognize O'Mara from the first novel, an Irish woman whose shape is still unknown to us, filling the role of both Omega and Alfred's Chamberlain. She is stiff with Tabitha, but only because she is fiercely protective of the well-being of the Lowell pack. We also get the reason as to why Alwyn had been trapped for so long in the menagerie. That gold bracelet he'd been wearing was like a curse. Any amount of gold can trap a Versapellis in their animal shape, and if left long enough, they will lose their sense of humanity. As Timothy and Tabitha make their way back to the cottage, they quickly figure out that Alwyn is following them out of sight, but they're not disturbed by this. They've long understood that lurking is in his nature. He is a lion, after all, and somewhat protective. Tabitha expresses a desire to see the Curcio, though it was impressed that it's not a good idea for Homus Plenum to be in attendance. But her request is heard by a certain duke trying to figure out how to repay her for her intervention during dinner. As he muses on this the next day, he finds himself at the paddock for Felicity's breeding stud. Another callback, the headstrong mare Delilah, known for her wild temperament, is happy to spend some time with Alwyn. He is able to talk out his concerns, and then he sees in the distance Miss Tabitha. However, it looks like he's not the only one in Lowell with an eye on the Honorable Lady, and he's figuring out if he could court her as well. But dwelling on this only reminds him that his lion is still missing, and being with her risks further pain. And, speaking of which, the next parts of the narration gives us further insight to the workings of the pack. Tabitha comes across Omara, who isn't really all that happy with her. It left me wondering what the heck is Omara's deal, because while she's not expressive, she's not really hostile either. As it turns out, Alwyn's presence among the pack is causing some disturbance. It's Omara's job to make sure everyone is working well together, important when a pack is as large and diverse as the Lowell pack, and the addition of another Alpha Versipellis is causing some tension. In addition, Alwyn's past and current condition is setting everyone on edge, much the way a community would when they find out that one of their number has been severely harmed. Alfred's discussing this particular problem with his Gamma, a boar shifter named Mr. Gambon. I'm only telling you his shape because, I mean, come on. I also mention him because, if I am reading the subtext correctly, Mr. Gambon is of a certain persuasion. He's gay, I mean. And oh, what's this? The group of them suspect that Tabitha's brother might share similar tastes as well? LGBTQ representation in my shifter regency romance? I'll take 10, please. Thank you. And everyone loves and supports Mr. Gambon. Even Alfred offers advice. Gambon feels out of sorts with the well-traveled and schooled Mr. Barrington, but Alfred assures him that the difference between mates help keep the relationship fresh. And furthermore, it's established that having a prejudice against someone who identifies underneath the rainbow flag would be total hypocrisy, considering the secrets they already have to keep. Oh my god, I need more of this. Inject it straight into my veins. When Alfred asks if it's possible Timothy is Gambon's vera amoris, the fellow doubts that the bond could occur between men. That's when Alwyn helpfully pops up, as a cat is wont to do, and states that it's common among the felines and others of his family, that it's of no consequence to them. Later on, Alwyn arrives to sneak Tabitha over to watch the Curcio. While they wait, Alwyn gives her a small explanation of the differences between wolf customs and lion customs. Those wolves like to make big spectacles like the Curcio, but the lions prefer to keep to their own. He also talks about the vera amoris bond, but how it relates to the community as a whole. For the vera amoris bond to take place, they need the protection of a pack through the power of the Centio. That's just the connection between everybody in the pack. However, Alwyn is the last of his family as far as he knows, and he has no pack or pride, but lions can have an added layer to the vera amoris bond, one that draws and protects all around them, not just their own pack, called the Canuccio. It is different than vera amoris bonds, but is just as powerful, if not more. He is not able to get the full explanation out, however, before the pack comes running through. Tabitha is delighted at the event and discovers that as long as she's met the person, she can tell who's who while they're in their animal shape. They nearly get discovered, though, which of course gives them excellent opportunity to sit low and close together.
"Are you quite all right?"
the Duke whispered in her ear. Tabitha could smell his soap, earthy, rich with a top note of bergamot, and his lips tickled her skin. She nodded and yet did not move her head from his shoulder. When had her head fetched up against his shoulder? She trembled and he tightened his hold, and then he sighed and his lips moved against her jaw, his nose tucked behind her ear, and he inhaled, gasped, inhaled again, and said, "Miss Barrington." But we aren't allowed to get all that steamy yet. Right as it's about to get good, one of the horses from the pack run up upon the two, and Tabitha barters with him not to tell on her. When she turns back to the Duke, he's vanished. Something that I don't see very often in romance novels is a wide variety of social interaction. I don't know if it's the Regency setting or the author's style, but Tabitha is getting a lot of dialogue with other characters who are not the hero. One such instance is the Lady Jemima, a dove shifter that we met in the first novel. Jemima is a skilled seamstress and fashion designer intent on decking everyone out in the height of fashion, and Tabitha is not immune to her machinations, and Jemima is able to offer some support for Tabitha as she makes her way through this unusual world. There is such a large support system for our characters in these series. Even if they've been brought far from home and their families, our stories have ensured that they are not lacking in comfort and company outside of that romantic setting. Basically, long story short, it's full of women supporting women. The men don't have as much time with the support as the women do, but that might be because the men have, so far, already been a part of the Versipellian culture, where the women have to be introduced to the community. It's thanks to that support that Tabitha is able to address her feelings and begin to wonder if there could be anything between her and Alwyn. I haven't really mentioned it yet, but Tabitha is 35. In Regency terms, she's basically off the market. She remarks that the purpose of marriages, outside of political matches, of course, is to ensure offspring. And even today, women who become pregnant after 35 face harder challenges than the younger women. There's even a lovely term for it, geriatric pregnancy. So Tabitha believes that there isn't really anything that she can offer Alwyn, other than her royally decreed assistance to his healing journey. But Jemima and others assure her, Versipellians are different. Not only do they not mind older mates, as they tend to have longer lifespans than humans, but they also have a neat trick of ensuring pregnancy when they want it. Infertility be damned. It also has the handy side effect of preventing pregnancy when it's not wanted, so that's a plus. After her visit with Jemima, Tabitha heads back to her cottage to ponder over her situation. Could she and the Duke have anything? Furthermore, while he seemed healthy in spirit, she's not sure if she's any closer to actually helping him. Wound up in all of her thoughts for him, she lets her mind trail over more sightly parts of his visage. And again, the author treats us to a scene not often found in your typical romance stories. Masturbation. And because Tabitha is a doctorly sort, she has a different way of looking at things. His breath on her jaw, his lips on her ear. She slid a hand down to her belly to her feminine place. She corrected herself immediately. She would not allow her clients to resort to euphemism, and she would not allow it in herself. Her fingers slid into her vulva and teased her clitoris. There, adult terms for an adult woman. But she mustn't be doing very well if she was thinking so clinically. Tabitha might be disparaging herself for her choice of vernacular, but I'm not. It's refreshing to see a heroine not shy away from those more clinical terms. As sex positive as I am, I was still raised in a culture that hides sex away behind curtains of shame, and even today these terms are still somewhat jarring if I'm not expecting it. It's exactly why we need more of this in our romance media. We're stuck in two worlds with this. Either we get genteel drivel from publishers like Harlequin that panic at the thought of the word vagina, or we get hardcore porn that can't go two pages without screaming the words cunt or pussy at us. Novels like this, like The Shifters of the Beau Monde, employ this wonderful middle ground, giving us more direct depictions of sex and masturbation without careening us straight off into the pornography cliff. Having said that, both of those classifications are perfectly fine in general. It's the middle ground that we've been lacking. Alwyn is starting to wonder himself if Tabitha could be, perhaps, his fated mate, but without his lion, there's no way for him to know. As he ponders on this, talking to the mare Delilah, he's alerted to a disturbance in the bush. He finds, to his horror, another horse, but context clues tell us that it's not just any horse. The animal is clearly lost, the worse the wear for lack of grooming, and clinging to him is a rug bearing the Templeton crest, as in Felicity Templeton. Fans of the series will know the stallion as Himself, that's his name, Himself, the reluctant stud who escaped during the events of the last novel. Felicity has been fraught with concern for him, and it looks like we've finally found him. Well, Alwyn's found him, and he's not happy about it, because he sees a shifter that's been kept in captivity by one he thought was compassionate toward Versipellians. He brings the horse to Tabitha and Felicity, and Felicity is shocked at the sight of her lost horse, and Tabitha can tell immediately that the shock is only going to get worse. Alwyn turns his righteous rage onto the innocent Felicity, but it's likely he says it more for himself than anyone else.
Every day that passes leaves less and less humanity behind. The struggle to remain balanced and in one's right mind become more and more arduous. The days I woke up and wished I'd never risen at all. The days when I did not know how I would find the strength to keep my poor lion from wreaking havoc on all around him, out of fear and rage and loss of his agency. I will not see it visited upon another.
Alwyn is becoming the person he needed when trapped in his lion shape, and hopes that in some way it can help him heal and move forward. Tabitha steps in, assures Alwyn that it's not as it seems. Himself, whoever he is not trapped the way he had been. If he had been trapped by gold, no one would have been able to tell, not even him or others, that the horse was a Versipellis. The spectacle has gathered some attention, drawing Duke Alfred and Domara to the scene, and when she claps eyes on the horse, she absolutely loses it. He transforms back into a human, assuring her that he'd never betrayed her, but she explodes into her shape, a horse, shockingly, and bolts off. Obviously, there is a story in there, and one I hope we get to explore in the future, but I'll tell you all now that Omara does not return to the story. The incident does allow Alwyn to be able to approach Tabitha later on about and to open up about his capture. He'd been lured by the sound of a crying baby, a woman in trouble, but it had been bait. His protective nature in full swing, he charged into his lion without thinking, and the woman had put the golden chain around his paw. Worse still, the woman was also Versipellin, hunting down her own kind for profit or for sport. But Alwyn's defenses are down. He is able to approach what had happened to him, and finally might start properly on the path that might bring him back to his lion. He has been unable to bear anyone touching him, and his appearance has suffered for it. His clothes are not well tailored, and worse, his long, glorious hair has suffered. Our moment of emotional intimacy has allowed him to open up to physical intimacy and to begin a proper courtship. And we need to remember that intimacy is not just sexual contact. The act of touch is very personal indeed. Some folks give it willingly, hugging everyone that will permit them. Others are far more reserved. For those in the latter camp, any touch, be it a hug or a hair washing, can express more than their words could. It's a show of trust that one is willing and even happy to allow someone else to offer physical affection. As the tangles in his hair unravels, they are able to open up more to each other. When she's done, Alwyn asks for the privilege of kissing her hand. Tabitha allows this, and hand kissing very quickly leads to lip kissing. And lip kissing would very likely lead to body kissing had Timothy not chosen that exact moment to show up in Tabitha's workroom. How convenient! Timothy wanted to thank him for some basil that he'd left and brought to Tabitha, so now he could make this Italian dish that he's been craving. Would the Duke like to join them for dinner? Of course he would. You're not fooling me, Timothy. I can tell what's up. Dinner is an extremely informal affair compared to the high society atmosphere in Lowell Hall. It's just Timothy and Tabitha and Alwyn. The conversation serves as both slice of life and helping move the plot along, just as I like it. More so, we get a dose of actual proper history. Timothy is skilled in a number of languages, and he pulls out an old slang language called Polari. It's still used today in Ireland, but it's long been the refuge of rustabouts, theatrical players, and, of course, those in the gay subcultures. Considering that Timothy is gay, it absolutely delights me to see this connection. Alwyn is able to use his language, thanks, unfortunately, to his proximity in the show and the menagerie. Timothy is able to open up as well to them, explaining the reason that he and Tabitha had been traveling in the continent. Essentially, he was literally being hunted down and chased out of England because of his sexual orientation, and Tabitha was getting caught in the crossfires. So they left, and while Tabitha reveled in their adventures, she loved traveling, Timothy was happy to be properly back home. There's more, a lot more to that story, but the point is that Tabitha and Alwyn both have trauma in their pasts, and as they connect, more of their stories come out, and as more of their stories come out, they can build further connections. Their relationship is following a logical path, one that Timothy is very capable of seeing. He has to go out on an evening stroll, of course he does, and has no problems leaving Tabitha with the very honorable Duke of Llewellyn, who would surely never get up to any shenanigans with his beloved sister. Shenanigans immediately ensue, Alwyn leaning over the table with Tabitha on top of him, getting as many kisses as she wants to give him. He tells her that he wants to court her properly, to come out on top of all of the other suitors chasing after her. She tells him that she needs some time and space to consider it, and he respects her wishes. Something else we need more of in modern media, men backing off the woman the moment the woman asks for space, and not disparaging them for it. In that space, Tabitha does wonder if she wants to be pursued at all, and weighs the choices and suitors laid out before her. The bee and the goat and the frog had not declared at her, a mark in their favor. The very notion of breaking crockery with any of those, she could not picture it. Oh, but Tabitha could easily recall the picture his grace made. Spread out on her kitchen table like a gruff banquet, those eyes lambent in the candlelight, the feel of his strong body beneath hers. His mouth, his tongue, blessed Palu, his tongue. The sensation that flooded her being when their hips had rocked together, the sheer sensuality of everything about him, the heat of his body, of his hands running up her back, the sounds he made, a cat purring, its satisfaction at getting its way, all of that hair and his eyes and those godforsaken lashes. I love the fact that she's picked up on his invocation of Palu and added it to her vernacular. It's a nice little touch into the progression of their relationship. Alwyn is not dissuaded by Tabitha's request. Indeed, he is happy to let her engage in the hunt for herself. While he thinks on this, he, Alfred Gambon, and the Lowell Beta Bates are out in the village making repairs. They are then come upon by some unexpected visitors. Duke Arthur and Beatrice have come to visit, along with Benjamin, Charlotte, and their three children. We met all of them in the last novel. The need-to-know deets are Beatrice, despite being a regular human, acts as Arthur's beta. The children love their new auntie Beatrice, and the youngest of the cubs, Ursula, is a suspected Omega in the making. The whole lot of them are bears, besides Beatrice, of course. And another surprise, a coach carrying the famous lady author, Anchoretta Asquith. She's been mentioned quite a bit in the past novels as an author who writes about horrible noblemen who prey on innocent women in fearsome animal shapes. She's also a versipellist herself and has several fans among her characters. And Alwyn doesn't like her on sight. He's not sure why, but he really, really doesn't like her. He is almost torn apart in an internal battle. Stay and guard the vulnerable from whatever threat she's posing, or run as far as he possibly can away from her. I think I hear the plot getting ready to boil. He is not the only one, of course. Tabitha comes across the scene, enchanted by the sight of Alwyn entertaining the three children, and frightened by the arrival of the author. She can tell something was wrong, and if she could not, the protective stances Arthur and Alfred were taking would have clued her in. I didn't mention it earlier, since there's already a lot that goes on in this novel, but we came across a group of traveling performers as they lugged their broken cart into Lowell Close. They were on their way to Arcadia, to Duke Arthur, as his family has long been patrons of their performances, when their horse bolted and they'd gotten their trained bear to pull it for them. It's the bear that has our attention now. The players were nearby when the author arrived, and their bear was making an angry beeline right for Miss Asquith. Interesting. And from her viewpoint, Tabitha notices that while all of the adults were distracted by the bear getting it to calm down, no one was watching the children. Children who were now being approached by Miss Asquith, who was reaching a hand out, and Tabitha could swear she saw a glint of gold as the little boy admired the lady's gloves. Tabitha doesn't hesitate and runs. When the author notices her, the gold disappears, if it had ever been there in the first place. Pleasantries are exchanged, if not endured, as Tabitha makes proper introductions. It's quickly clear that Miss Asquith is not a pleasant person, and understands quickly that Tabitha can see right through her bullshit, and little Ursula, budding Omega with the lack of filter that often accompanies young children, straight up tells the author that whatever she's doing isn't going to work, and she's going to lose. It's nice to know that we don't have to beat around the bush this late in the game. The author has long been incoming in this series, constantly referenced, and now she's finally seen. She's been of particular interest, if not controversy, among her characters because she writes stories of shapeshifters, painting them in a rather horrid light, as well as coming dangerously close to exposing all their secrets. Now we get to see that she might be in something other than publishing. Tabitha is quick to warn Beatrice and Felicity, and the three friends make sure everyone in the vicinity will be on guard from Miss Asquith. As Tabitha leaves the stable where they were conversing, she passes by the bear in one of the paddocks and gets a feeling. We can't dwell on it, however. There are bigger fish to fry. They've asked the players to put on a play, of course, Hamlet, fitting as Tabitha plans to engage with the play-within-a-play motif. As she prepares her portion of the plan, the dutiful Duke makes his way to visit her. He has one goal, to fully make his case for her to permit his courtship. And he makes a very convincing argument with his mouth between her legs. Amusingly, as we watch from Tabitha's perspective, we get bits of scientific names for body parts, and instead of taking me out of the scene, it matches up so well with Tabitha's personality that it's almost unnoticeable. And the scene itself is just delightful. No one forcing each other or retreating. Tabitha even offers to return the favor right before Timothy arrives back at their cottage. Darn. All the same, it's time for the play, and a quick aside tells us that Asquith is definitely up to something. We see her come upon the strongman from the performer group, and we don't see him again until he's running up to Tabitha, yelling at her in the most unconvincing of manner that the Wild Lion of Wales has returned. He has changed at last, but on a rampage, and Tabitha is the only one who could tame him. Tabitha knows the setup when she sees it. The poor man does not seem to be in his right mind, but she follows him, her guard up. Unfortunately, she needed to be looking down instead, and she's led right into a pit trap. She is not at all surprised to see Asquith, who is happy to gloat above her. The pit is filled with a plant that Tabitha is not familiar with, called neem. Loyal readers will know that it hides scents of those who wear it or use it. Tabitha's scent would then lead someone out to the woods, but then they'd be able to lose the trail and become ensnared by whatever Asquith was concocting. She gives her villain monologue, touting how she uses her books as blackmail for the Versipellian community, and hints that Alwyn would find himself prey to poachers once again. Doesn't look good for anyone right now. Meanwhile, Alwyn is waiting to watch the play, looking out for Tabitha, where he feels a familiar presence. His lion is finally able to make itself known, and they have a reunion as heartfelt as if they've been able to embrace. His lion insists that, hey, we went through some shit, I needed some time to settle, but I'm here now, and we gotta get with our vera amoris. The play gets started, and Asquith just interrupts their whole plan and runs into the crowd, shrieking that there's terrible news! Tabitha's been abducted! Hilariously, everyone can see that she's full of it, and Alwyn's lion tells him as much. But they all fill her ego and goad her into her performance to figure out what the hell is going on. Gosh, Lady Asquith, this all does seem like one of your books, but we should all go look for Tabitha. I have no idea if she could pick up that they picked up on her crap, but she tips her hand, saying, oh, I'll keep watch over the little cubs while you go search. All of the alphas present basically form a protective circle around the children, growling and whatnot. Now that Alwyn is in connection to his lion again, he can feel his sentio, and that means he can feel that Tabitha is, actually right outside. They all demand further proof from Asquith, who looks quite insulted that she's not being believed, and that's when Tabitha, having escaped the pit, enters into the fray. Asquith pulls out a Hail Mary, the stone that she used to hypnotize the strong man into tricking Tabitha, and now she's trying to use it on the whole group. Tabitha is able to resist it just long enough to yank it out of the author's hand. No other options left to her, Asquith shifts into her shape, a snake, because what else would she be, and flees. Tabitha, being the only one who can be near the gem without total ill effect, is escorted to her cottage to examine it. That's where she gets a scolding from Alwyn about jumping into danger, and they part, but not in a third act separation kind of way. A bit of a trope turner, really. They aren't splitting, they're just giving each other a little more time and space. It's nice. She also gets a scolding from Timothy to let herself be cared for. She spent her life taking on the burdens of everyone around her. It's time that she allows the people in her life to help her. She's getting some hard truths, but she needs to hear them all the same. The next day, the players are trying to put on their aborted play, where Tabitha can't seem to look away from their bear. She makes her way to the stage, where the bear is willing to approach her, and Tabitha sees a golden chain around her neck. Alwyn is at her side, and he helps her break it. In a plot twist that I never saw coming, the bear transforms into Arthur's missing mother. I knew that there was something up with the bear, coupled with the fact that they kept reminding us that gold not only traps the shapeshifters, but hides them as well. It's the mother that surprised me. I'm sure the clues were there, but I was distracted by our couple. And if you like an action-packed ending, Asquith jumped out of nowhere, likely able to sneak around anywhere given that she was a snake, and grabs Tabitha with a knife to her throat. Oh yeah, she was the one who originally trapped Alwyn and the newly found Dowager Duchess of Osborne. She wanted you all to know that. And here Alwyn gets to have his triumphant return. He changes, along with the rest of the more intimidated shifters, and with the help of everyone, they subdue her. Tabitha is still cross with Alwyn, and she says so in front of him. How much it would have hurt her if he had been taken again in her defense. She storms off, promising that they would have words. It's made all the better that he's still in his lion form as she does this. It's not every day a woman can yell aggressively at a lion and not get mauled. What follows is simply the tying of loose ends. The Dowager Duchess thanks Tabitha for her help, and Prince George, having stopped by for the play, pushes her in the direction of the Duke. He's been making his cottage up, taking it from one bachelor pad to a quaint love nest. There's no major ceremony here. All Tabitha has to do is walk over the threshold, and they are mated. She does, and boy, they don't waste time enjoying each other's company. It's as happy an ending as anyone could want. Alwyn is not tied to any lands like Alfred or Arthur, so he and Tabitha are free to roam the world, just as she always wanted. And along the way, they can find and help any Versipellis who may need it. They give farewell to their friends and sovereign, and head out onto their adventures. And was I as pleased with the Duke at the door as I was with its predecessors? Honestly, I could go on forever about it, so let's just jump right into Heather's final score. The cover, first as always, is a 4 out of 5. There's a lot to love here. I love the contrast of colors, the determined look on Tabitha's face, the lion statue to the side, but like a most unusual Duke before it, it doesn't hit that fantasy dreamlike aura that the first novel did. I miss it, and I'd hope that future installments, should there be any, I hope, harken back to that first introduction. Drama is a 5 out of 5, because it is all over the place in this novel, not just in practice, where the pressure to help Alwyn brought Tabitha into his arms, but also with the actual dramatic performances. The final scenes with Asquith were hilariously delightful in their execution, hitting note for note the climax of old adventure novels, and it all paid off in the triumph of Alwyn being able to return to his lion shape. Apart from all that, there were oodles of slice-of-life drama peppered in all over the place. It made everything feel tangible and real because it was people living their lives. Everything might appear chaotic to a first-time reader, but fans of the series will be enchanted with more of what they love. Romance is a 5 out of 5. Both Tabitha and Alwyn had a natural progression into their relationship, and nothing felt forced. The more time that they spent with one another, the closer they grew. They both had problems they needed to address within themselves, and it blended into a mutual healing and intimacy that felt genuine, and slotted perfectly into the pacing one would expect from a Regency romance. Spice level is going to get a 3 out of 5. It could have gone higher, I'm sure, but we can only be so spicy when Regency rules are in place. Granted, the rules were a lot looser in this novel, thanks to Tabitha's age and past experiences. Her time spent abroad took most of whatever shyness she might have had, and Alwyn was happy to give her any attention she desired. It also plays into a near-perfect middle-of-the-road spice that I'd like to see more in general romance, where sex isn't secret nor is it pornographic, that it pulls us out of the story. Realism is going to be a 2 out of 5. Yeah, it's low, but that's okay. It's kind of the joke. Of course her story is going to get a lower score because, you know, shifters, but in the end it's the over-the-top dramatic flair that takes us out of the realism straight into melodrama. And it's fun. We can see the play-within-a-play motif used to great amusement to all, and the machinations of Asquith were entertaining as well as menacing in that classic villain style. And we get to pull out world-building today, which gets a 4 out of 5 from me. The novel did an excellent way of building and reinforcing what we knew, and as well as teasing future discoveries. There's that risk, like I said, of losing new readers, but I can say with confidence that readers wanting to read more will be more than happy to indulge in the other books. And there's so much more that doesn't really fit inside any of these categories. One big example being setup and payoff. Plot threads left to previous novels were found and tied up here, such as the story of himself. It was suggested that Felicity Stud Stallion was not a horse without saying as much, but now we can get confirmation. And who knew that he'd be connected to our O'Mara? And while we got loose ends cared for, we got new setups to look forward to. And speaking of setups, once again we're treated to surprises that I'm not expecting to see in mainstream off-the-shelf romance novels. The approach to sexual matters, such as masturbation and sexual knowledge, is always refreshing to see, especially when it's shepherded by a no-nonsense apothecary and healer. And of course, the LGBTQ representation paired with actual historical language used by the community is just wonderful. I'll be honest though, on my first read-through, I don't know if I was gripped the same way that I was with the first two novels. However, my subsequent reads were as enjoyable as I hoped. So, with probably no surprise to anyone, A Duke at the Door joins the rest of the series on the Gold Star shelf, with 5 liberated Lion Lords out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwong Hyun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an HBK production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.